Okay,
well, let's see what's currently in going, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed at the exact same spot the whole time. They're not far, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marley,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, good day. No matter where you're listening to this program, whether it's live via the big antennae in Montreal and Toronto, whether it's live via the web or the podcast. Good to have you out there. Welcome to edition 413 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight, Dave Ferlot with his take on it, Canadian documentary filmmaker and on the road on his four-month North American odyssey in an RV gathering interviews for his current project, UFOs and the Politics of Reality, David Cherniak with us in the next half hour, and Mac Tonnies and Greg Bishop will join us for the final hour. They're both speakers at Paul Kimball's 2006 New Frontiers Symposium, Extraterrestrial Life, Space Exploration, and the Future. That's happening next Saturday, October 14th, in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Brian Vike had an interesting happen to him on September 24th. He says he awoke to his telephone ringing, and he talked to a guy who was reporting a sighting from his truck radio phone. And suddenly the phone connection was lost, and Brian had no way of getting back to him. So he stayed up for a short while, hoping the guy would call again, which he did, using a normal phone line. The static and dropout while they were talking, Brian Vike says, was terrible, but he did manage to ask if the UFO event was still happening. And the guy said yes. He was calling from Castlegar in British Columbia. He said that while in his truck using the radio phone, it started to switch channels and he had no control over it. Brian asked him if this had ever happened before, and the guy said no. On August 2nd, he said in 2006, he and his wife were out in the Badlands with a camera on a tripod and watched as an object came from high above and stopped away away from them and just hung there. The object, over a period of time, shot back up and disappeared. He caught all of this on still pictures, and he explained that the images are crystal clear, he told Brian Vike, and that both he and his wife are baffled as to what it was that they might have seen. Interesting. That's almost like something out of Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, isn't it? The pickup truck. And the X-Files. There was that parody of that one in one of the X-Files episodes. James Randerson, the science correspondent for The Guardian in Britain, reports the British Ministry of Defense went to extraordinary lengths to cover up its true involvement in investigating UFOs, according to secret documents revealed under the Freedom of Information Act. The files show that officials attempted to expunge information from documents released to the Public Records Office under the 30-year rule that would have revealed the extent of the Ministry of Defense's interest in UFO sightings. In particular, the ministry wanted to cover up the operation of a secret unit dedicated to UFO investigations within the Defense Intelligence Staff. UFO conspiracy theorists have likened the unit, called DI-55, to a sort of Men in Black agency for defending the Earth against invasion. But the released documents show this is far from the truth. One 1995 memo from DI-55 to the MOD's public UFO desk said, "I have several books at home that describe our supposed role of defender of the Earth against the alien menace. It's light years away from the truth." The files were made public following Freedom of Information request by David Clark, a lecturer in journalism at Sheffield Hallam University, and his colleague Andy Roberts. The documents don't tell us anything about UFOs, but they do show how desperate the MOD have been to conceal the interest which the intelligence services had in the subject, said Dr. Clark. The trail begins with a request in 1976 from a UFO enthusiast called Julian Hennessy for access to the MOD's records on UFO sightings. A note from the UFO desk to the MOD head of security on March 23rd shows that officials intended to refuse him access on the grounds that the files contain confidential information and very little of value to a serious scientific investigator. But the note continues, "This is not to say that the investigation is not taken seriously. The branches have their own methods, and the public UFO desk has no need to know about them. But we are aware that DI-55, for example, sometimes makes extensive inquiries." Apparently, the full extent of DI-55's involvement has subsequently been made clear by a report released to Dr. Clark in May and reported in The Guardian, in the Manchester Guardian, well, the London Guardian now. They threw up a 500-page document which brought together everything the unit knew about UFOs or unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs, as the Ministry of Defense prefers, including 10,000 sightings. It said the existence of UAPs was indisputable, but blamed the most vexing sighting on airborne plasmas formed during more than one set of weather and electrically charged conditions or during meteor showers. Well, you've heard us talk about the Kinross incident on this program in the past weeks. It looks like it's turned out to be a hoax. We'll have more on that particular topic with David Cherniak.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlock.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list that got me thinking about ufology in a little bit of a different way. The thread is called Futures Bleak for UK Ufology. And the thread made me start thinking about ufology in general. And it amazes me every time I hear people say, "Oh, UFOs? Nah, I don't believe in that stuff." Ufology is the study of unidentified flying objects, and although that sounds pretty cut and dried, it encompasses more than most of us are prepared to deal with. You see, it would be real simple if we had some footage of an interview with an alien, or if we had one of the spaceships sitting in a park somewhere on display, like we do with World War II and Korean War aircraft. It would even be simple if someone came forward and showed us a piece of technology or even an ashtray out of some UFO. But we don't have any of that to point to. What we do have are hundreds of thousands of people reporting things in the sky or on the ground that they have not been able to identify. Think about that for a second. I think I'm a pretty normal guy. And if I see something in the sky, my brain processes what my eyes are seeing, and almost instantaneously I receive a message saying, oh, that's a plane, perhaps a Boeing 767, or that's a bird, perhaps a Canada goose, or that's a helicopter, or that's the planet Venus or some other star in the sky. And if I'm on some kind of obtuse angle, it might take a few moments more for my brain to decipher what my eyes are seeing. But usually, not more than a minute later, I can identify what is up above me. Now, please take note. I do not immediately say, that's some kind of alien spaceship, and then try to prove that it's not by trying to determine if it's a bird or a plane, a helicopter or something in outer space. And I don't think I'm any different than anyone else, which means when somebody reports seeing something they can't identify, they have already tried to identify it as something they do recognize. Now, what makes this kind of testimony or report even more interesting is when it comes from somebody who is intimately familiar with anything that flies. I'm talking pilots, astronauts, cosmonauts, radar technicians, control tower personnel, and even Air Force personnel. But that is only one part of ufology. My good friend John Velez was on last week discussing abductions by aliens, and we have thousands of people who are relating experiences to us that have no other explanation than they were abducted by aliens and subjected to some manner of investigation by those creatures. You see, that's the interesting thing about ufology. It's not just about flying saucers and aliens. We have cattle mutilations that some scientists believe might be associated with ufology. We have crop circles that some people associate with ufology. We have progressive technology that people are linking to back-engineered alien technology. We have ancient artifacts and technology that some people believe were brought here by aliens. And we have people looking at things on other planets within our own solar system saying that there are things there that show evidence of some alien race or technology. Now, I don't know if any of all of these things are valid. I do know that there are some things from all aspects of ufology that I simply can't explain away with some rational or all-encompassing statement. And I challenge anyone to come forward and say that they can do that. You see, for every one thing that can be explained, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands, that cannot. Not all UFO sightings are meteorites or planets or swamp gas or an overactive imagination. Not all abductions by aliens are sleep paralysis or an overactive imagination. Yeah, it boggles my mind when somebody says, I don't believe in UFOs, because it's not a matter of believing or not believing. It's simply a matter of examining the evidence. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Vermont, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
So there I was, Dave Furlott, 4:45 yesterday morning, and I got this urge to go look outside.
Uh-huh.
And there was this, what I took to be an airliner.
Okay.
All lit up like a Christmas tree.
Uh-huh.
But it was moving away from me. And pretty darned high up.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if aircraft are flying away from you, and they got the headlights on, and they're all lit up. When they're flying away from you, you don't get to see too much of them. You don't see lights the way I did.
That's kind of true. That's
mm-hmm.
true. That it's usually you only really see the serious lights when they're landing.
When they're coming towards you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I tried to figure that one out, and that sort of hurt my brain for about 20 minutes, and then then I went back to saying, well, no, they must have lights on the back end now.
It's possible. They might.
I rationalize.
Bottom line was, you did identify it as an airliner.
Well,
right?
I was pretty sure it was an airliner.
Okay.
Well, that's what I thought it was at first, but then I thought, no, it's flying away from me.
The trick is, your first thought was, well, I think it's an airliner.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to determine whether it really was, as opposed to, oh, that's a spaceship.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the way most people think.
And we're at the stage now where people see condensation trails in the daylight
mm-hmm.
sky, and it's chemtrails.
Yeah,
how do you know they're chemtrails? I keep seeing posts on other lists from people in the Toronto area who keep insisting on calling them chemtrails.
Yeah, yeah.
We live on one of the busiest air traffic routes in North America, other than Chicago, perhaps, and New York. And these people are seeing chemtrails.
Yeah.
I don't see contrails anymore.
Can't be condensation.
Well, I saw an object in the sky and something came out of it, so therefore it must be a mothership.
And the other thing that annoys me is people who pluralize the word craft.
Oh, yes.
Crafts. Yeah, as in arts or
yes.
in elephants. A herd of elephants, a herd of crafts.
Yeah. A herd of crafts.
A
whole
of
bunch
crafts.
Of crafts.
Yeah, and we won't go into Iraq and Italian, but anyway, that's, you know, it's got nothing to do with the price of UFOs these days.
This is true.
Yeah, and too many sheeps, too, as Julian just said
sheep.
In my ear. Yeah, too many sheeps. Chemtrails and sheeps and crafts.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think we beat this one.
Yeah,
good.
I think we did. I think we need to stop it right now. Thank you, Dave, for a lot.
Thank you.
We're having too much fun again. People will grumble. We're not serious enough.
No.
Good night,
no.
Dave, for a lot.
A good day.
Thanks. Well, he's been on the road, it seems like forever, in his recreational vehicle, come studio, come crew transport. Come saving a whole bunch of money on hotels. David Cherniak is a Canadian documentary filmmaker who's on the road, driving around North America, gathering interviews for his current project, UFOs and the Politics of Reality. Joins us on the line. Where are you, David Cherniak?
Errol, I'm sitting in a Ford service center in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
After 16,000 miles, UFOs Are Us, which is how we christened this RV, has lost its fuel pump.
Oh, no.
Yes, lost it late on a Friday afternoon, stranded us in Knoxville for the weekend, and God knows we may not get out of here until Tuesday.
Oh, my.
Well, yes, but the RV is electrified and waterfied, and we have the internet dish up, so recording
oh,
the program.
Oh, good.
Right, and I'm sitting here with Gord Heath and Sarah Barnes, who are traveling with me on this leg as we shot in parallel. We've shot a lot of the Moncla Memories material down in Louisiana with some of the family and some of the places where Gene Moncla lived before he went off to Kinross.
Before he went off to Kinross and got involved with an unidentified radar return.
Unidentified radar return. URR.
U-R-R-O-U-R-R-U-S. Us, exactly. That's where I was trying to go, and my mouth wouldn't cooperate.
Well, it's age, Errol. It's just age.
You and I talked about Moncla and Kinross and how the Scorpion F-89 had been sent out to chase this unidentified that showed up on several radar stations' sets. Merged with the blip on the radar, and then both the jet and the object disappeared off the radar. That was in 1953. Fast forward to earlier this year, or was it last year, and an outfit called Great Lakes Dive Company that suddenly showed up out of nowhere on the web, mm-hmm. announcing that they had, in fact, located the wreck of an F-89 Scorpion jet fighter and a mysterious object 200 feet away from
mm-hmm.
it, laying 1,000 feet down on the bottom of Lake Superior.
deep down in Lake Superior.
Deep down in Lake Superior.
Yes, yes, indeed.
It sounds almost like a Gord Lightfoot song.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yes. Both you, yourself, and the week before Gord Heath, we had all talked about this on the radio, and there was actually a lot of sitting back by the old-timers who are way more experienced than some of us in the UFO field, waiting to see what happened next.
Right.
And what happened next was that the Great Lakes Dive Company website suddenly disappeared.
Right. And the contact stopped returning phone calls to most everybody who we know about.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very, very interesting. Some people are speculating that the whole thing is a hoax. And some people are suggesting, well, you know, let's wait and see. I kind of, and I know Gord does too, we kind of sit in the latter camp. It does seem a little bit suspect, you know. They could be being bombarded by rabid UFO-type people with all kinds of emails and questions. And, you know, they just may want to lay low for a while and consider their options.
But the Mutual UFO Network seems to think that this is probably a hoax.
Well, we still haven't seen their rationale, and I haven't heard their rationale for it.
Mm-hmm. You know,
there are certain things, I think, that are suspect. Their website did go down. They're not returning calls.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that conveniently there is an object 200 feet away with a dent in it that had suspicious kind of qualities, really at the edge of things.
Yes.
You know, it could be some kind of PSYCOP-sponsored PSYOP campaign against UFO researchers or filmmakers doing films on UFO subjects. I think we'll probably find out. But for the time being, I think we should probably just sit back and wait to see what MUFON's going to come forward with.
Yes.
And take it from there.
When I talked with Adam Jimenez after both you and Gord Heath had been on the program, he told me a couple of things that really weren't sort of public knowledge and asked me not to talk about them publicly.
Right.
And I thought,
everybody got the same message, yep.
And I think, as far as I know, there's only one person who's published anything, but that's away in a subscription area part of the website, so not
right.
many people have seen that interview.
Just, what might you be talking about?
Oh, nobody.
No, and what subjects might you be talking about that was not published?
Are
you going to spill the beans?
No, not at all. No, until we know one way or t'other whether this is actually a hoax or these guys are just laying low until the spring and they can go do further exploration with a documentary crew in tow.
Right.
There are interesting sort of sidebars to this story. But the thing that made my heart stop was when I tried to call Gord Heath to get his opinion on it.
And he wasn't there.
He wasn't there. Not only wasn't he there, but his phone wasn't there either.
His phone went south too, yes. Well, Gord decided that life on the road with David Cherniak was a good thing to do, so he sold everything that belonged to him and decided to pool his resources and float around North America for a while.
And when you sell the RV, he will come as part of the furniture and fixtures and furnishings. Yeah.
He will go with it, and you know, we should get good money for Gord.
Yes, I would think he's a very talented man.
Do you want to say hi, by the way?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, here he is.
Hello, Errol. I don't know what it is that David's saying about me right here. Although I did sell my place, but it was more a coincidence.
I was telling David that it was a heart stopper after Great Lakes Dive Company's website
disappeared.
And then you disappeared. And then I was making concerned phone calls out to the West Coast, hoping that somebody out there knew what was happening. And fortunately, David called me back soon after I started to get worried. So.
Well, we've been having all this speculation on this trip that one or more of us is going to disappear on this trip, through some strange encounters. You never know, it might happen yet.
David is on the road doing two projects, UFOs and the Politics of Reality, and with you as the subject, Moncla Memories.
Right.
For Vision TV. The first one is for History Channel up here in Canada.
Yeah, that's right.
I look forward to seeing them both, and I look forward to talking to you again when we know a little more about what the heck is going on with Great Lakes Dive.
For sure. I mean, right now we've got some images, which might be one thing or another. They aren't in themselves much as far as evidence. From what they've told us, they do have some rather definitive evidence in their possession, but they haven't at this point shared it with anyone because they are holding it for their documentary.
Yeah, well, they haven't shown the evidence to anyone, but they've talked to several people about it, including myself and you and
right.
David Cherniak. And,
yes.
Yeah, I particularly like the satellite story. That's an interesting
satellite story. I don't know if I've heard that.
Well, and I'm not going to repeat it if you haven't heard it.
Oh, okay.
Well, at least not live on the radio in front of at least 27 people.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure there's at least that out there.
Gord, it was good talking with you again.
Okay, and we'll be
in touch
again when we find out more.
Are you coming back this way with David, or are you heading off back out west?
I'm going to be heading off back out west sometime in the next 2 weeks or so.
Okay, so you're not coming to Toronto first?
No, I don't know. Damn. That might happen at some time in the future.
When you do, you be sure and let me know, and we'll go and have a couple of beers together. How's that?
For sure, let's do that.
Good, let's do that. Okay, good night, Gord Heath. Can we hand back to David?
I'll do that right now.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Errol.
Thank you, Gord. Gord Heath, who was the Canadian investigator into the Moncla Kinross mystery, that Gord Heath. Hello, David Cherniak. You're in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville, Tennessee. Yeah, coming. Last time we talked, I was in Temecula, California. I've been all over the Southwest, seeing some people you know, some people you don't, actually.
You saw Wendy Connors.
I saw Wendy. Oh, yeah, Wendy and I, we danced and partied all night.
Yeah.
And Bill Hartman and Travis Walton. And
how was Travis?
Travis was great.
He's
a little bit reluctant to do interviews these days, but
right.
He did do one with me, and he was very, very animated. You know, he really comes across as one of the most sincere people I've ever met. Could not believe for one moment that he was not telling me one thing that wasn't true.
Of late, he seems to have been, even when he's appeared in documentaries, a little withdrawn and introverted.
Not when I talk to him.
Good.
Very, very animated is how I would describe
mm.
it. Yeah. I have to tell you, I had a really interesting time with William Hartman. Bill Hartman was, for those of your audience who don't know who he was the photographic analysis for the Colorado Report, and took a look at virtually everything that proceeded, you know, in terms of major pictures and everything that happened while they were doing the report. And Hartman was quite candid. He's now more an artist than an astronomer. But in the interview, he very much allowed that, for one thing, that the report itself, and particularly Condon's conclusions, had more or less shut down scientific interest in the phenomena.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, but he, for somebody who's actually sat on the study to admit that, I think, who didn't get fired,
for objecting to the preconceived result of the Condon report.
The other thing he talks about is his feelings about Condon's more or less summary dismissal of the photographic evidence. In fact, in the report, in his conclusions, Condon spends more time talking about photographic analysis that was done outside the study rather than his own photographic expert. So he talks about that a little bit, and his regret and some, I think, hurt about how that happened.
The images that Bill Hartman looked at, were there any that completely stumped
sure.
him?
Oh, sure. I mean, one of the one that he talks about, I think, in the most interesting way are the Trent pictures, you know, the pictures that were taken by the farming couple in
yes.
McMinnville, Oregon, a series of two that he basically says, this may represent a metallic object of unknown origin.
There was a lot of discussion, I guess, about a year back on the UFO updates email list about the, you know, the pros and cons of those photographs. There were several skeptics who said that those were hoaxed pictures by the Trents in McMinnville.
I haven't seen any evidence that says that in any way conclusively. One of the people we'll be talking to in probably this coming week will be Ray Stanford, who's just completed a new analysis of the Trent pictures. And he was telling me yesterday on the phone that I don't think I'm breaking confidence because he didn't swear me to any confidence, that he was skeptical about the Trent pictures up to just a few weeks ago. And now he's completely convinced they're 100% true. Not a hoax at all.
Yeah, I miss Ray Stanford on the updates email list. He used to be a regular contributor, and
What happened?
I think he's had enough of the new ufology. Yes.
Oh, you mean you get your skin scorched off?
Oh, yes.
The new ufology.
That's happened on occasion when the moderator loses control or lets it go for a grin or two.
Right.
From Knoxville, you're headed where, David Jr.?
We're supposed to be talking to Fred Durant III. Fred Durant III was one of the scientists who sat on the Robertson panel in 1952, the CIA's secret panel, to look at the evidence and to basically dismiss it and recommend debunking and ridicule to remove UFOs as a national security problem, which emerged during the summer of 1952 with the Washington flap. Fred's in his 90s, but still quite alert and seems quite anxious to talk. Doesn't believe a bit in UFOs.
Mm.
We'll see whether I can change his mind after all these years.
And if anybody can talk the hind leg off a donkey, it's David Jerniak.
Oh, yeah. I do that every day. Absolutely.
I can barely talk
the hind leg off myself.
We'll be in touch again in the next couple of weeks or so before you get back to Toronto. And then maybe we'll sit down across the desk here in the studio and talk at length. Thank you for being with us.
I'll tell you all kinds of good stories as I post the film, Errol. How I nearly slash my wrists once a week.
Good night, David Cherniak.
Good night, Errol.
Say hello to your nice researcher there, and thank all three of you for being with us. Mac Tonnies is an author from Kansas City, Missouri, with an abiding appreciation for thought-provoking literature, weird and/or subversive ideas, and bleeding-edge art and science. So says the website of the Futures Conference, which is happening in Halifax, Nova Scotia, next Saturday. That's the 2006 New Frontiers Symposium. The bio on Mac Tonnies continues and says his most recent book, After the Martian Apocalypse, is an examination of the prospect of extraterrestrial intelligence on the Red Planet. And Mac is currently working on a third book about the crypto-terrestrial hypotheses for the UFO phenomenon, and his critically acclaimed blog, The Post-Human Blues, which I lurk every day, I have to tell you, posthumanblues.blogspot.com, takes a daily look at cutting-edge ideas and esoteric theories with balanced skepticism. Joining us on the line from his home in Kansas City is Mac Tonnies. Mac, finally, we get you on Strange Days Indeed. Good evening.
None too late. Most appreciated, to be on.
It's good to have you on. You have, to my knowledge, been around for many years.
Yeah, I think signing up for UFO updates is one of the very first things I did upon discovering the Internet, which would have been maybe in 94 or 95 at the latest.
95, yeah, because we started big time, I think, February of 96. So it would have been right around that time.
Okay. It's
actually
kind of been a fixture in my life. I can't do without it. I take a trip and I send you a message and I say, please unsubscribe me and then I'll be back.
Yeah.
And you're always very good about that.
Well, a churn is part of my life. You know, people signing up and unsubscribing, it's the way of email lists. And what I'm particularly grateful for is people like yourself who, for whatever the reason, unsubscribe and then a little while later pop back up.
What I'm particularly grateful for is that it's a moderated list. I don't know of any other, or at least any other that I subscribe to.
The interesting thing for me, Mac, is that it seems to me that you're one of the few people who are relatively public figures as far as the whole Mars scene over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are the Mark Carlottos and others.
Those more qualified than I.
Well, yes.
Technically.
But you're fairly public with your views on all of that.
Yeah.
And the interesting images that have popped up in the last few weeks out of the European Space Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Some have described the horned face. as being much like the cat box pictures of the face that were taken a couple of 3 years back
and released
to the public without any sort of cleaning up of the images that the cat box picture really needed to have done to it.
Well, the cat box, they cleaned it up all right. The cat box, you know, that's an issue that probably warrants a good program in itself. I think the cat box release is devastating evidence. I'm not a huge conspiracy theorist when it comes to Martian anomalies, which is always cause for bewilderment when people encounter my views on that. They just assume the two go hand in hand. But at the very least, I do think JPL very much wanted to kill that issue and stifle any more discussion, you know, for whatever reason, probably academic. And the cat box certainly did the trick, or so they hoped.
Mm.
And the ESA perspective shot, which isn't even a real photo, it's a computer-generated image, and it's flawed. And there's some scientific analyses forthcoming showing exactly why it's flawed. My original reaction to it was, I think, is justified, that the horn protruding out of the forehead simply isn't there. It's an exaggerated vertical elongation of formation, whether it's natural or artificial. I'm agnostic. I don't want to believe. I just want an investigation. So far, I have seen very little action toward that.
The images that we have seen, not only of the Mars face and the Cydonia region, mm-hmm. where there appear to be geometric shapes that would not naturally occur in nature, do you recall seeing the worm pictures?
Oh, the worm pictures, yeah. The worms and or the glass tubes.
Glass tubes, ribbed glass tubes.
Those got huge interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually quite skeptical. I think the glass tubes are natural formations. We see variations of those in lots of pictures.
Unless they were a transportation system around the planet at one time.
That's one hypothesis, and I'm not saying it's invalid. I think it's highly unlikely.
Hmm.
For one thing, if this is a transportation system, there is no rhyme or reason to the planning. You would expect some sort of, not necessarily blatant evidence of construction or design, but you would expect some sort of sensibility to the whole thing. Instead, they have this very very natural-looking tendency to kind of swarm across the terrain and wrap around the sides of mesas. Mm-hmm. I highly suspect we're seeing a geological phenomenon, an interesting one. I'm not going to rule all of them out. I can't prove an unknown at this point. I can't wait for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to get some high-res pictures.
At the symposium, what have you decided?
I am speaking, and actually this wasn't my decision. This was Paul's, and it was a good one. I'm going to be speaking on, not Mars this time, I'm going to be speaking on futurism. I'm going to be talking about the post-human condition, where the human race is headed over the next 100 years, over the next 1,000 years, and what we might be up to and what forms we might take. And that's a subject that excites me greatly. And this will be it's an interesting opportunity to kind of synthesize some viewpoints that I like batting around and expressing them to an audience. You don't get an opportunity like that every day.
Other than the blog, of course.
Other than the blog, and typically, people you meet day to day aren't especially interested, but we have a nice venue and a nice lineup of speakers, so it's a very, very different setting.
Yeah, Halifax is a great place to visit.
I've never been there, but I'm really looking forward to
it. Yeah, especially at this time of the year when they have fog and
rain.
That's
what I've heard.
Yes.
That's what Paul tells me.
Yeah.
Halifax in October.
It's a maritime city, you know. I want to let listeners know that there are several links to various aspects of your life in tonight's program listing at virtuallystrange.net, and click Strange Days Indeed. It'll take you to Max Posthuman Blues blog, and every day there's something new and interesting to watch or to read or hear there. A fascinating place to go if you're interested in what the futurists are seeing for our future, or some of the futurists are seeing for some of our future.
Yeah, I kind of spread it out. Lots of different possible futures. I'm not committed to one in particular, but I think we can see some trends developing.
And what sort of trends do you see as far as the UFO field is concerned?
Yeah.
Do you get any sort of gut feeling about that at all?
It's strange. I tend to think of UFOs as kind of a quantum phenomenon, and in the sense that they are two things at once. They are nuts and bolts in the sense that they're physical. I think we can conclude that, you know, whatever they are, the core phenomenon seems to be a physical reality. But at the same time, there are pronounced effects that we describe in psychic terms. So there's a really interesting convergence there that really challenges just about everything we think we know. That gulf there, that duality, really draws me in.
I find it interesting being interested by many things that come under the umbrella paranormal.
Right.
There are a lot of paranormalists who refuse to look at UFOs, and there are a lot of ufologists who refuse to look at the paranormal.
Yeah, it's funny. It's an interesting field. And the face on Mars is an example. Very few ufologists give a darn about the face on Mars or any other enigmas on Mars. Science fiction is another example of a very, it's kind of an exclusive, isolated field, you know, and kind of a marginalized field at that. Attending conventions and so forth, there's no crossover into the UFO, or very little.
In MUFON Ontario, some of the folks from there were invited to go to a science fiction convention here in Toronto, I guess about, well, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, and a widely publicized seminar, and there were three people in the audience.
There you go. I'm not surprised at all. Superficially, you'd think there'd be, you know, some commonality. If you just take a glance at the media and the memes that are spreading around, and but really, there's not. They're very mutually exclusive, in my experience.
And mine, too, and that of MUFON Ontario.
Also, the science fiction crowd is also most allied with a very hardcore transhumanist movement, and they're very territorial, sometimes kind of bitterly so, you know. They see things like UFOs as a very pronounced threat. I was recently accused on my blog of threatening the transhumanist movement with my unhealthy fascination with UFOs or something like that. And yeah, I thought that was endlessly funny.
And the transhumanists accuse the UFO people of being cult-like.
Yeah, talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah,
I mean, there are problems in both camps. I'm kind of a synthesist, you know. If you read my blog day to day, you have posts on ufological things next to technological things and environmental links, and I don't see any cut and dry distinctions between these things. I don't like compartmentalizing things intellectually. I like making them fuse and seeing how they fit together. You see if there's patterns there in the noise, and to be sure, a lot of it is noise. To compartmentalize things and create little tidy barriers between fields of disparate weirdness just strikes me as just absurd.
Well, it's all just weirdness all together now. All of it really, really does need to be looked at in much more depth than it has been.
And as long as you keep a skeptical mind,
yep.
I think that's the key. As long as you don't swallow something hook, line, and sinker, and whether that's convincing yourself that the destiny of the human species is to upload itself into, you know, Jupiter brains and become omniscient at the end of time, or, you know, or whatever. And these are ideas that, you know, are very far out and technically, theoretically possible, but some people just adhere to this with almost religious zeal. And, of course, the same criticism can be leveled at ufology. You have certain beliefs that typically go unchallenged when they very well should.
Mac Tonnies is speaking this coming Saturday, next Saturday, at the 2006 New Frontiers Symposium, Extraterrestrial Life, Space Exploration, and the Future. That's happening in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I wish I could be there, Mac. Unfortunately, even UFO radio doesn't pay a lot of money, and Julian out in Master Control here in Toronto is looking at me saying, really? Yeah, so I'll be here just earning my meager pittance instead of having a good time with you guys in Nova Scotia next week.
Well, I'm sure it'll be a good time.
I'm sure it shall. A great bunch of speakers and a really good producer, so
yes.
You guys are guaranteed a good time, no matter what.
Very, very smartly, I believe.
Mac Tonnies, thank you, sir. I wish we could have spent more time together and look forward to doing more time together at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Not a problem. I was very happy to be on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Have a good night.
You too. The 2006 New Frontiers Symposium, produced by Paul Kimball. The title, Extraterrestrial Life, Space Exploration, and the Future, which is happening next Saturday, October 14th in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And also speaking there next week in Halifax is Greg Bishop. Since its founding in 1991, the Excluded Middle has become a popular zine exploring ufology, Fortiana conspiracy, psychedelic worldviews, and things that go bump in the night, and sometimes the day, too. Co-founder and editor Greg Bishop has gone far beyond stories about Nikola Tesla and Wilhelm Reich to publish Kabbalistic analysis of Dr. Seuss poems and unearth historical data relating to early UFO contactees. Greg is a leading exponent of both and logic in a predominantly either-or world. His articles have appeared in Fortean Times, The Conformist, UFO Magazine, The Nose, and Book Happy, and he's also been featured in Donna Cosey's Kooks, A Guide to the Outer Limits of Human Belief, and the anthology Zen in the Art of Close Encounters, Crazy Wisdom. Greg's radio show, Radio Misterioso, airs Sundays from 8 till 10 p.m. and can be heard on the Los Angeles-based internet station Kill Radio. Radio Misterioso, an esoteric blend of paranormal talk radio and music from the edge and, more often than not, beyond the edge. Introduction almost as long as the interview is going to be. Good evening, Greg Bishop.
Hi, how you doing, Errol?
I'm doing good. Good to have you back on. I think it's, second or third time you've been with us.
That sounds like an older introduction. I've had two books out since that one.
This is hot off the press at the Futures 2006 website.
Oh, okay. Well, and he forgot the Project Beta book on Paul Benowitz.
I was about to come to that, and I was about to say the last time you were on, we talked about Project Beta and Paul Benowitz and how some feel that he was hounded to death by persons relatively unknown.
Well, he was hounded into a bad mental state and certainly bad health. I'm pretty sure it did shorten his life.
You're talking at the symposium about the contactee movement?
Yeah, it's been an interest of mine for, probably when I first... In fact, the first thing I had published in Donna Cosey's Kooks magazine was about the Aetherius Society and the Unarius Society in Southern California here, since they were easily accessible to me, since I grew up in San Diego and I live in L.A., and so it was easy to visit those two groups and see what they were doing, what their message was. My talk at the conference has to do with 1950s-era contacteeism and kind of going beyond just laughing at them and their antics at the time and seeing if there was actually something there. I mean, did they have some sort of contact with some extra human consciousness? And I think maybe a few of them did. I don't know if it continued as they claimed, but I think that some of them did, because there's a lot of parallels between what happened to them and what happened to other people of a spiritual bent. Carl Jung actually said that Orfeo Angelucci had what he called a prototypical archetypal religious experience. And based on Angelucci's education and background, he was fairly certain, and I am too, that he couldn't have made up the entire thing and had it fit into this framework of spiritual awakening or whatever you want to call it.
Contactees, for the sake of the new listener, back in the 50s, as Greg said, there were a lot of people who claimed that they had been taken by benevolent beings to the home planets of those benevolent beings.
Yeah, or at least been visited first and then taken there and then had subsequent contacts, etc., yes.
And most of it, of course, later proved to be nonsense, because most of the planets they claimed to have visited were, in fact, there was no way for anything to live on those planets.
Yeah, but, well, at least as far as we know it,
exactly,
in the way they described it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, some of them said, well, that's because I visited them in an etheric plane, and they just, they live on Venus, but in a spiritual form, so they got around that one. The funny thing is there was a precedent for this, because Helena Blavatsky, who founded the Theosophical movement, claimed some sort of channeling or spiritual contact with these ascended masters who she said lived on Mars and Venus, and this was in the 20s and 30s. So either the con has been going on a long time, or if we want to look into it deeper, these people do get some sort of contact with something that is not coming from inside their heads, which I think does happen occasionally. And the only model they have for that was, and still is, well, they must be from another planet. Well, now every time there's a new discovery, it moves further out. You see, first it was Mars and Venus, and then it became planets further out, and now it's other galaxies and planets revolving around other galaxies.
The classic example of the Canadian who had contact with, as he called them, the boy's topside, was Wilbert Brockhouse Smith.
Oh, that's right.
He wrote some interesting stuff about his contact and some of the technology that he was given, designs and things. And
Oh, now I'm going to have to include this because I didn't even know about this. I didn't know the details anyway.
Yeah, Paul Kimball may jump up and down a bit if you happen to include him. There is some interesting work going on literally as we speak right now where there are some people putting together some of the gizmos that Smith was given from the boy's topside.
Yeah, this has been going on for a long time. Howard Menger said that he was given the plans for a free energy device by the space people, and of course it never really worked too well, and the ones he came out with in the last 10 years don't seem to work too well either, except as charging two different plates with different polarities, and they repel each other, and he says that's anti-gravity. But then you look at someone like, and you mentioned that I'd written about him, and a lot of listeners know about him, is Nikola Tesla, who visualized these objects and mechanisms and many things that he patented, ran tests in his mind so that when they were built, they're fully functioning. He and other inventors, writers have said this too, they feel like they're acting as a conduit for information from somewhere else.
Yes, exactly. And whether that's channeling or it comes to them in dreams, it's what Mac and I were talking about earlier on, trying to separate UFOs and a lot of the psychic abilities. It's trying to compartmentalize the paranormal and separate them out.
Yeah, you run into problems if you do that.
Yes. there's all kinds of crossover, as I keep saying.
Yeah.
Nikola Tesla always impressed me, a man who seemed to be just light years ahead of his time, and a man who basically was ripped off and stiffed by a lot of people during his lifetime.
Yeah, well, he was a very trusting soul. He remained that way to the end of his life, unfortunately. I mean, he had a little bit of a shell that he built around himself after 20 or 30 years of people taking his ideas or rejecting them because they couldn't make money off them. What he wanted to do, his grand dream, I think many people know, was to provide a power source for everybody that anybody could pick up right out of the air. And since George Westinghouse, who had hired him at the time when he developed his AC alternating current system that we all use right now, asked him, well, how are we going to meter for this? How are we going to charge people for it? And Tesla said, well, I don't want to charge people for it. I think that should be available to everybody. And that doomed that idea from the start.
And that went the way of water-powered cars and everlasting nylon stockings and razor blades and.
I was doing some research on electric cars. Apparently, Tesla invented a car. They took a Packard or something like that. They took out the engine. They put in an electric engine, and he rigged up something underneath the hood. This was in newspapers. I've seen newspaper accounts of it, with a little antenna or pylon or something sticking up out of the trunk, I believe, or at least out of the glove box. He turned it on, and they drove around for about a week with it, with no batteries or anything. He said it was a method he invented to transmit the power through the air so the car could just run off at wherever he was. So apparently all you have to do is set up something like a bunch of cell towers, I suppose, and these cars could run everywhere forever as long as there was power coming through that grid.
That's the image at the front page of the Virtually Strange Network on the left-hand side there, is that power or energy emitter that he had designed that looked like a huge lighthouse with a microphone.
Yeah, I think that was called Wardenclyffe or Wycliffe Tower.
Wycliffe Tower was on Long Island.
Mm-hmm. I believe Westinghouse gave him the money to start that, then realized, one, it was going over budget, and two, where he was going with it, and that he'd ultimately not be able to charge people for that power. He pulled the funding for it.
I don't remember where I read it, but there was some talk about Tesla having some sort of extraterrestrial connection there somewhere.
He said, I believe, and this is a long time ago that I'd read this, that I think he believed that he was getting transmissions from Mars or somewhere off the Earth. He was picking it up on his wireless setups in the 1890s, I believe. He actually had a radio-controlled boat that he took into Central Park and controlled with a remote control before Marconi was even sending messages.
Code.
The more you look into them, the more you find out he was far, far ahead of everybody else. I kind of have a theory about that in relationship to what we were talking about with these inventors and creative people kind of pulling ideas out of another dimension or another time or wherever, that he was connected to that, and these ideas all exist constantly. They're just something that exists independent of time or our perception of it, and some people are somehow able to tune into that on the frequency they want, if we want to call it something. And Tesla's expertise was in technology. And the perfect form of whatever he was looking for existed somewhere, somehow, and he was able to pull that out of whatever that file drawer or whatever you want to call it and bring it down to our level and make it work in our world. And if he had lived longer or he was alive now, there's no telling what would come out of that. I can't think of anybody comparable at the moment.
Except for maybe Wilhelm Reich.
Had some of the same theories with the ether, and he was coming at it from a psychological and biological standpoint. And he said that he had built motors that ran on this etheric power, which he called orgone.
My mother has an orgone blanket for her arthritic knee. And
does it work for her?
Oh, yes. It's been working for years for her.
William Burroughs had an orgone box. He swore up and down contributed to his longevity. And considering the kind of life he had and what he was doing to his body, I'd be inclined to believe him.
We're going to have the real middle-of-the-road serious ufologist not totally thrilled with the last 5 minutes of this conversation.
There was an interview recently I did online, and I just said my ideas about what's going on with UFOs and their connection to other areas like spirituality and non-time and space-bound areas of thought is not real popular, but it's a very old and strong undercurrent in ufology. It's just the nuts and bolts people from other planets crowd have ruled the field since 1947, 49. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out in the article that really hasn't gotten us anywhere except for a bunch of theories that aren't really provable. They're provable to ufologists. Importantly, they're not really provable to anybody outside ufology. Partially that's because of closed minds and the scientific establishment, but it's also because we have no way to produce these things upon demand. And they exhibit so many different properties besides just being a ship that lands and some beings get out. The effects on witnesses and on abductees and all that go far beyond the physical effects.
Greg Bishop, thank you, sir. It's always fascinating talking to you. I wish you a lot of luck next Saturday in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Go to tonight's program listing, go read about Greg, go see his work, and get involved that way. And look forward to talking again soon, Greg Bishop. Good night, sir.
I do, too. Thanks so much, Earl.
Thank you. Next Saturday night, ladies and germs, our British correspondent Stuart Miller, John Velez, and Alfred Lemberg. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Jim Pacheco and Julian McNabb. We shall see you next week. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.